Thank you for listening to Upaya's Dharma Podcast, an extraordinary series of talks from some of the finest Buddhist teachers in the world. I'm Joan Halifax, founder of Upaya Zen Center, and we're so happy to make these podcasts available to you. If you find this talk of benefit, please consider making a donation to support us to continue offering these recordings freely. You'll find a donation button on our podcast page. And thank you so much for listening.
This is Dharma Podcast at dharmapodcast.org. This is show number 805. It was recorded on April 10th, 2013. And it is titled, Melding the Western and Buddhist Traditions. The speaker for this episode is David Loy. Also, a reminder, recently Roshi Joan launched a Google Plus community on engaged Buddhism. Please visit us and join this active and growing community. You can find it by searching for Buddhism or Engaged Buddhism on Google Plus communities page.
Thank you for that very warm and generous introduction, and also to all of you for coming. And the topic for tonight is an example of that passion. About 50 years ago, Gary Snyder, the Zen poet, wrote something like this, quote, "The mercy of the West is social revolution. The mercy of the East is insight into the basic self / void. We need both." For the purposes of this talk, I would translate that as follows. The highest ideal of the Western tradition has been social transformation to make a more just society. And the highest ideal of the Buddhist tradition has been insight into the true nature of the self, or what we sometimes call the emptiness of the self. We need both, not only because they sort of supplement each other, but I think it's more intimate than that, that actually, in order for each to realize its own ideal, it needs the other. And one of the really distinctive things about our time, I think, is that it's now with globalization, as these two great traditions come together, that we can see why that's so. So that's what I'd like to talk about, just sort of show the relationship, the necessity for bringing the two of them together. And I'd like to start out by using the issue of morality as a way to draw the contrast. Not referring now to the content of morality, that is, looking at the specific precepts and comparing them with specific commandments, but rather I'm more interested in the context, the way in which morality is used in the Abrahamic traditions, that is to say Judaism, Christianity, Islam, which have been so formative in creating the Western tradition, how morality is understood and how central it is there, and contrasting that with its role in the Buddhist tradition. We sometimes describe the Abrahamic traditions as ethical monotheism, and we focus on the monotheism, right? One God. They all talk about one God. But I want to focus on the ethical, because I think what's really distinctive about those traditions, and it's carried over to our Western tradition, Western culture, is that that is the primary axis. That is the main way that God relates to us, basically telling us what to do, telling us how to live, and promising certain rewards, perhaps, if we do, but also certain punishments if we don't. So when I say axis, it seems like the main axis for those traditions is good versus evil. And the most important thing, then, to to be a practitioner is, which side are you on? It goes all the way back to the story of Adam and Eve, which to me seems like a parable about, or a myth about, the development of self-consciousness. And yet it's interesting that it's told in the Bible as an act of disobedience. We're punished for disobeying God. And this continues. I mean, think of Noah's flood, killing almost everybody. Why? Because we weren't living the way that God wanted us to. And then later, we look at Moses getting the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. So again, this seems to be the main way that God is relating to us, telling us how to live with very specific recommendations. And it carries through even with Christianity. I mean, Christ adds a new element. There's more focus on love, and he has a more intimate relationship with God, Abba, the Father. But still, that fundamental moral grounding is there. And the reason I go on about this is that even though in contemporary Western culture, many people no longer believe in the Abrahamic God, still, I think that's the sort of primary story, the main spectacles with which we view the world. We don't have to think very hard. Or let's just say it's our favorite story. If you think about just some of our favorite films or film series, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, James Bond, Avatar, interesting turnaround there, right? But I mean, what's going on in all of those? Basically, the basic plot is all about the struggle between good and evil. And what I really want to focus on for the moment is how this axis, this struggle between good and evil, or this way of viewing the world, is both good and evil in itself. Or let's say both very beneficial and yet also very problematical. So let me just say a little bit about those two sides to it. The problematical first. From a Zen point of view, we can say that the duality between good and evil is a pretty important example of bipolar thinking in general. By bipolar thinking, I mean thinking that involves opposites. Many of them are innocuous, like high-low, big-small, strong-weak. But some of them become more problematical. Problematical because it's the nature of these dualities that you can't have one without the other, because the meaning of each is the negation of the other. In other words, they always come together, right? So it sounds like we have two concepts, but really it's one concept, two sides of the same concept, right? If you don't know what high means, you're not going to understand low, right? In many cases, as I said, there's nothing problematical about it, but in some cases it is, because this is functioning not only logically, but psychologically, this non-duality. For example, suppose the most important thing to you is to live a pure life, however you understand that. What that means, of course, is that you are going to spend your life preoccupied with impurity, right? With looking for and avoiding impurity. You can't take the one without the other. Another example, wealth, poverty. If the most important thing to you is to become wealthy, rich, you're going to be just as concerned or afraid about being or becoming poor, right? And getting more to the point of this specific talk, the duality between good and evil is, I think, in some ways the most problematical one, especially the way that it's played out in history. Because again, we can't know what is good until we know what's evil. And we can't feel that we are good unless we are fighting against that evil. And that's where it gets tricky. You could say, well, the struggle might be within us. I'm reminded of a wonderful quotation by Solzhenitsyn, the Russian novelist, who said, how nice and easy it would be if all we had to do was identify the evil people out there and defeat them. But, he said, the line dividing good from evil cuts through the heart of each of us. and who wants to cut off a piece of his own heart? Well, there's a solution to that. If we can identify the evil as something out there, then we can feel, hey, we're the good guys against the bad guys over there. I think you can see where I'm going with this. The irony here, of course, is that what this means is that one of the main causes of evil has been our attempts to get rid of evil. Hitler, what was he trying to do? Getting rid of the Jews, the homosexuals, the gypsies, and so forth. He's trying to purify the earth. Stalin was doing the same with the wealthier kulaks, the peasants, Mao Zedong with the landlords, and so forth. But rather than looking down on those examples, I wonder whether we have a better example for us with the war on terror. What was the real difference between George W. Bush and Osama bin Laden? They were both fighting the same holy war between good and evil. Of course, they reverse valency. What one thought was good, the other thought was evil. But it's the same, it's really the same understanding. Part of my being good is that I'm trying to destroy that guy over there. And I'll leave it to you to reflect upon how much evil this has ended up creating. I personally remain shocked that we have become a nation that has accepted things like torture and that. Yeah. So that's the problematical side. But nonetheless, there's also something extremely wonderful about this duality. And what I would point to in particular is one aspect of it has been the prophetic tradition, going all the way back to the Hebrew prophets, right? What were they doing? They were going to the kings, the rulers, and they were saying, God is going to punish you because you're not behaving the way that you should. You're oppressing the orphans, the widows, the weak. So what they did was they brought that concern for goodness and justice into the social dimension, where it has stayed ever since. And especially when you combine that with the other root of the Western tradition, that is to say the Greek, right? The Abrahamic and the Greek. We say Jerusalem and Athens. What did the Greeks realize? Well, that if we didn't like the way that our society was structured, we could change it. We could restructure it. We could try to make it a better society. Of course, the Greeks, the Athenians, their democracy was pretty poor in a lot of ways, but they started something. And basically what I'm getting at is, especially in the modern world, bringing together the realization we can transform our society and bringing together this prophetic concern to make our, to make sure that our rulers are just and good. Basically what we've got to, I think, what it's led to is, as I said at the beginning, this fundamental ideal, the highest ideal of Western civilization, I think, that we can restructure our society, we can make it more socially just, which has led to things like human rights, anti-slavery campaigns, civil rights movements. More recently, we think of gay rights and so forth, bills of rights. A lot of this, most of this, or if not all of it, I think, comes out of these two elements. And yet there's a problem. I mean, we have this ideal, and yet what we notice is that it doesn't seem to be working quite as well as we might like. It seems, I mean, we're noticing that now in the United States, where the gap between rich and poor is getting worse rather than better. It seems like there's something in the way of realizing the ideal. And what might that be? Well, here's where I'm going to point to the importance of personal, individual transformation. Look at it this way. Supposing I'm a revolutionary who overthrows some nasty dictator, and now I've got complete power. But if I haven't worked on my own greed, ill will, and delusion, what's likely to happen? Having absolute power, it's going to be very difficult to avoid sort of, you know, taking advantage of that for my own benefit. to avoid seeing the people who have different ideas as enemies that need to be destroyed. And if I still have the sense that, you know, my superior judgment, my well-being, if I still have this kind of basic ego, then the tendency is going to be very strong to think that the solution to all the social problems is simply me imposing my will, my ideas on the whole of society. In other words, what I'm pointing to is that this personal dimension seems to be getting in the way. And even that example, we don't have to make such a complicated example to see the problem. Suppose we had the most perfect democracy that you can imagine, and the most perfect egalitarian economic system. But if the people in this system are still primarily motivated by greed, ill will, and the delusion of separation, the delusion that I can pursue my own well-being, my own benefit, you know, separate from what happens to you, is that system going to work very well? It's not. And I think, frankly, that's what we're seeing now. I think we're seeing a lot of classic examples of that. Does that make any sense? So that's the one side. Now let me turn and just look at the Buddhist tradition. Please sit comfortably. Feel free to move your legs if they get stiff and so forth. I started out talking about morality. I mean, morality is important in Buddhism too. We know about the precepts. And yet, it really functions in kind of a different way. Because the primary axis in Buddhism is not good versus evil, but rather something like delusion versus awakening, or ignorance versus wisdom. It's something, there's something to realize, there's something more cognitive there, or in the broadest sense of the term. So there's a sense that morality is important, but ultimately their precepts are like training wheels on a bicycle, right? Once you sort of really realize, you should be able to let them go, in principle at least, right? It's significant that, as far as I can see, Buddhism doesn't have anything very similar to the concept of justice or social justice. You can point to a few things, but it doesn't really fit very. It doesn't work in the same way. For example, karma. In one way, you would think karma would be a perfect example, because it's all about, you know, getting what you deserve, or what you've done coming back to you. And yet the way that it tends to work doesn't have the same impetus, or at least the way that it's developed and applied in the Asian Buddhist traditions, it hasn't encouraged the same kind of concern for social justice. Because karma is understood usually as a kind of cosmological law, that what you do is going to come back to you, it means we don't have to worry about it. You know, we don't have to sort of pay attention to it. It's going to happen by itself. The problem, of course, is that that has encouraged a certain kind of passivity. You don't really have to take responsibility for trying to promote social justice. And in general, the Asian Buddhist traditions have not really been very good at that. It's an interesting question how much this was the original intention of the Buddha. In some ways, I see him as a more revolutionary figure than the people who succeeded him, although it's hard to parcel it out in the Pali Canon. But when you look at the Buddha's attitude toward women, incredibly enlightened for his time, and also his attitude toward caste, the way that caste disappears once you enter the order. I mean, that's quite striking for his time, very progressive. And perhaps we shouldn't project our own rather weakened idea of religion weakened in the sense that religion in the modern world is just kind of one sphere usually. But I think for most pre-modern religions, religion sort of permeates the whole society. It's all about the meaning of that society. And I think that the Buddha, as some scholars have suggested, may have had a more greater vision of a movement that was going to transform the whole of society. But in any case, it didn't happen. In fact, in the early days, the early Sangha was fairly dependent on royal support before it became sort of more popular. And it's a tricky thing about, you know, royal support. If you want support from the authorities, the powers that be, well, then you have to support the powers that be, right? So there's kind of a limitation built in there. As far as I know, the Buddha and Buddhists never sort of challenged kings in the way that the prophets did. The Buddha advised them, but he didn't sort of, you know, attack them or challenge them in the same way. And sadly, as far as I can tell, karma pretty early seems to have been used to kind of rationalize the power of the king or the ruler, right? You're born a prince. You must have really good karma from your past lives, so you know, you're going to deserve to be king. And you're born a woman. Well, I'm sorry. You must have done something bad in your past lifetimes, but if you behave yourself and you do what we men tell you this time, then, you know, future lifetimes you have a chance to become a man and that sort of thing. Now, I'm making a little fun, but the truth is Buddhism became a pretty patriarchal religion. And that was certainly the attitude of a lot of the bhikkhu. They really saw to be born as a woman is a sign of bad karma. So you can see the problem here, that what Buddhism ended up doing then was developing this incredible, the world's largest collection of contemplative practices and techniques to help us wake up individually and come to some insight into our own true nature. But when I remember the Buddha's original emphasis, when he said that all he had to teach was dukkha, suffering, and how to end it. As far as I know, he never said, I'm only interested in your own mental dukkha and all of that. He didn't focus, he said dukkha. And the problem, of course, is that we're very aware today that a lot of dukkha is caused by institutions, caused by oppressive social relations. And Buddhism historically has not been able to deal with that. We can understand it. None of the Buddhist Asian societies was democratic. You know, they had to be careful. They could be and sometimes were squashed if they got out of line. So, you know, this was how Buddhism survived. But this is the important point. Now that Buddhism comes to the modern world, not only the West, but even the Asian societies, they're, you know, becoming more democratic. Now there are new possibilities. And so we're in this exciting new situation where the Western emphasis on social transformation to create a more socially just society can come together with Buddhist deep insight into the problem and the nature, the dukkha, suffering of the self, and how we can transform, how we can wake up. We can see how, as I said at the very beginning, these two work so well together. In fact, what I'm arguing is they really need each other. How am I doing so far? Okay, you with me? Let me finish by saying a few words, giving an example, in other words, of how the Buddhist perspective can give us a different insight into the kind of social suffering, the institutional suffering that we need today. In other words, I think it's important to see that if we want Buddhism to become more socially engaged, it's not simply a matter of adapting Western concerns about, you know, justice, although I think that's part of it. But I think Buddhism has something very distinctive to offer when we look at our social situation. And I'll try to exemplify that by focusing particularly on our economic situation right now. Just say a few words about that. if we look at especially the incredible gap between rich and poor, and how much and how quickly it's growing now, how much the middle class is being eliminated, and how the 1% are just getting more and more and more, and how poverty is increasing, more homeless people and so forth. When we look just at that specific phenomenon from, say, a kind of traditional Western point of view, what comes to mind is, from a social justice perspective, is distributive justice. I mean, why should a few people have so much and so many have so little? There should be more distribution. We should have fewer rich people and we should have more middle class and the poor should have more, right? So let's distribute that collective wealth more equally. I think that's the sort of standard social justice concern. I think when we look at that position from a Buddhist perspective, we can see a couple other things. We can see it slightly differently. And again, not to replace that perspective, but to add something distinctively Buddhist and I think important. And I want to make two points, looking at it from an individual perspective and then from a collective or institutional perspective. Individually, I want to go back to what I think is the most important teaching of the Buddha, which for me is the connection that he makes between dukkha, suffering in the broadest sense, and this sense of self, the sense of a separate self, the self that feels itself to be separate from other people and from the world. This is the fundamental delusion, and as I understand what the Buddha was saying, this is at the root of our dukkha. In contemporary terms, we can understand it as something like this, that the sense of a separate self is a psychological and social construction. Newborn babies don't have it. The feeling that there's a me inside and all of you are outside, that's something that develops gradually. And because it's a construction, because this sense of self is never a real self, there's nothing substantial about it, because it's only the way that habitual ways of thinking, feeling, acting, reacting, and so forth. It's all of these patterns of thinking and feeling. It's the way that they work together that creates and sustains this sense of self, which means that it's always inherently insecure. It's always basically uncomfortable. The self can never become comfortable. And I think that's kind of what the Buddha was getting at by emphasizing the delusion of self, anatta. But here's where the problem happens. The way I like to express it is we experience that insecurity as a sense of lack, a feeling that I believe all of us have. In fact, I think it's one of the great secrets of life, the feeling that there's something wrong with me. You know, I look at all you look fine, you know, I can see you're real, but, you know, something isn't quite right about me. And the reality, of course, is we all feel that, and we don't know it. We sort of think it's just me. But this feeling of lack, where does it come from? And this is where the great problem occurs, because we don't understand its source in this delusion. Rather, according to the kind of society we grow up in, the way we're conditioned, we project it outside. We think, lack? Well, what am I lacking? What's wrong with me? Ah, I know. I don't have enough money, or I'm not famous enough, or I don't have enough consumer toys, or whatever. But especially in this culture, of course, a lot of it has to do with money and consumerism. What am I getting at here? Well, because we misunderstand the sense of lack as I don't have enough of this, this fits in perfectly to the kind of consumer economic system that we have, which depends upon, with advertising, always persuading us that it's the next thing we buy that's going to make us happy, right? It has to be the next thing, because the last thing only works for a few seconds, a few minutes, whatever. And this is the kind, and this is our economic system. This is what it's all about, right? That's how it functions, is constantly persuading us. I sometimes call it a religion, because if you look in terms of how it actually functions, the meaning of life, what's important in life, it seems to function that way, right? So the delusion of self experienced as a sense of lack for most of us functions as the kind of consumerist rat race where we can never get enough, we can never have enough, right? Notice I haven't said anything about morality here. Right? It's not about good and evil, it's about understanding who we are or not understanding who we are, misunderstanding our situation, misunderstanding why we have this sense of lack and trying to fill it in ways that simply cannot work. It's a kind of a trap. The system promises happiness, but it can never deliver. That is a Buddhist perspective on our economic system, you see. Not a moralistic one, but one in terms of delusion and suffering. Finally, let me look briefly at the institutional version of that. The Buddha's revolutionary understanding of karma was to bring in the notion of motivation, intentionality. That was really, people believed in karma, but he was the one who really focused on that. It's your motivations that create karma. In fact, I think we usually misunderstand what he was getting at. I think he was really pointing at the golden key to transform the quality of our lives. Not necessarily a simple key to use, but it is simple, but it's not easy to use. Basically, what I think it was getting at is something like this. If you want to change the quality of your life, if you want to experience the world differently, if you want people to experience you differently and respond to you differently, in other words, if you want to change the whole world you live in, there's a very simple way to do that. Transform your motivations. If you're motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, you're going to create problems for yourself and probably for a lot of other people too. If you're motivated by generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom, you know, the three problematical ones tend to close us off and separate us. Generosity, loving kindness, wisdom, we can relax, we can open up. People realize they can trust us. As those become part of what we are, the world that we live in changes. But here's the tricky thing. Today we not only have much more powerful technologies than in the time of the Buddha, we also have much more powerful institutions that take on a life of their own. That is to say, they have their own motivations built into them. Today we've institutionalized greed. It's our economic system, right? If greed is you never have enough, consumers never consume enough, corporations are never profitable enough, market share is never big enough, GNP, GDP is never big enough, it's got to keep growing. That to me is an example of greed. Briefly, we can also understand institutionalized aggression. Well, when I think about the way we treat our prisoners, and also especially our militarism, I recently came across an incredible letter. The AFSC, American Friends Service Committee, said that in 2011, if you include the cost of the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. spent $1,165,907,000,000. We live in the most militarized society in human history. Because we don't see uniforms all the time, because they're shunted off, we tend to miss that fact. And finally, we've institutionalized delusion. It's our media, right? The main media are mega corporations, and they're not there to inform us, to educate us. They're there to make money by selling us stuff. You know, they're not really wanting us to understand what's going on. Their idea is to perpetuate a certain worldview. Again, part of the consumerist mentality. Just focusing for a moment, as a way to end, focusing on the greed dimension again. Our economic system is institutionalized greed. Just think about the stock market for a moment, how it works. On the one side, you have all these investors with extra money. Why do they invest? Well, you know, that's what you do if you have extra money. You can gamble on the market. If you're clever, you can make money or whatever. But generally, their motivation is that. They're not so much concerned about what any particular corporation is doing, right? In fact, many of us don't know where the money is. It's in mutual funds and so forth. It's in pensions and all that. So there's this general interest in profitability, and then you have this black hole, this amoral, I would call it, black hole of the market, stock market. But on the other side, you get this unrelenting pressure. Unrelenting pressure experienced by every CEO for growth, preferably in the short run, in the next quarterly report. And if he or she, it's usually a he, can't respond to that pressure, he's in danger of losing his job, right? The important point here is how the motivation is institutionalized. It's not simply a matter of the motivations of the individuals. If they don't play their game, if they don't play their role, they get pushed out, you see. The classic example is if the CEO of ExxonMobil wakes up one morning and suddenly he's gone green, right? He realizes, oh my goodness, we're in a terrible situation. I've got to do everything I can to, well, if he acts on that, and if, as I suspect, what he does is maybe going to have an effect on profitability of the corporation, what's going to happen? He's going to lose his job. Not only that, if it's true for him at the very top of the pyramid, how much more so it is for everyone else down the line, right? In other words, the institution takes on a life of its own. It has institutionalized greed. And that's the scary thing. If the Buddha's right that the source of evil in his terms, he didn't talk about evil per se, but he talked about these roots of evil. If the roots of evil are greed, aggression, and delusion, and if we have institutionalized them, well, we have a lot of work to do, right? So I offer these as examples of what Buddhism can contribute, not focusing so much on the morality side, but more on the insight of how the Buddhist perspective works in terms of the three poisons, in terms of seeing this connection between delusion of self and suffering, and how this can be applied to look at institutionalized suffering. And I think it's become clear that at this point in history, we are all being called upon to respond to this, because as we know, we live in very challenging, very dangerous times that are about to become more dangerous. And I think in response, we need to see how we have to work on both of these, which, by the way, is what the Bodhisattva does. I think I'll stop there. Thank you. We have about 5 minutes for discussion. If people would like to respond or say anything. In the back, and then in the front.
I've been reading your books lately. You've thrown me into a moral dilemma. So, in America, I work in philanthropy. In America, philanthropy is very much tied to economic systems. Mm. The wealthier people become, the more they give. And if the wealthier people become, the poorer other people become. Mm. And it creates a real problem that in the greed to do good, like accumulate philanthropic capital, actually feeds in a system that hurts society. Talk about that a little bit or help me.
Could I ask you a question? I've heard that actually, in terms of percentage, poor people tend to give more percentages of their disposable income anyway than the wealthy do.
Yes, but that's not what drives philanthropy. Mm. Wealth drives philanthropy. So yes, poor people give more per person. But in terms of looking at charitable capital that's moving in society,
Right. That's a wonderful dilemma. Yeah. Good luck. Maybe somebody has some suggestions. I guess I'm not familiar enough with that world, although I can see the problem very clearly. I mean, why is it that Bill Gates decides
what society needs?
Yeah, he's going to see it from his perspective, what, charter schools and things like that? Which
in this community, we have folks who decide that what this community really needs is a bigger, better opera house. And so the vast majority of philanthropy in a community like this goes to support an opera house, while in 10 of our schools, 100% of the students live in poverty.
Wow.
And that's a dilemma.
It is, yeah. I wish I had some wise, clever thought to share, but I don't.
That's why I came
tonight. Ouch. Sorry you've wasted your time. Gentleman in the front, or almost front.
What would be a way to make Buddhism permeate the Occidental societies? How could you make easier for the Buddhism to be part of Occident? Because right now, it only select groups of people can participate. And if you want to transform the society, you gotta have the possibility of offering this knowledge to society as a whole.
Again, a very, very important and difficult question. I mean, I think it's going to take some time. I think we have to accept that Buddhism is still fairly new. We only have a couple generations. I know part of the problem is that my generation, a lot of us were sort of hippies who could live in these practice centers and practice intensively because we didn't have families, we didn't have jobs, we were sort of very, very marginal to the society. So that gave us a freedom to really focus on the practice in that way. But that doesn't work if you want to mainstream Buddhism, if you want to really make it an important part. So, I mean, clearly part of the challenge, and I think some places have done it much better than others, is, for example, family practice, right? What do you do with children? But also, it seems to be part of a larger problem with Sangha. It seems to me we have a lot of Buddhas, a lot of teachers, a lot of Dharma teachings, but we're still fairly weak on the Sangha level in most cases. Too often, it's relating to the teacher. You know, we come together, we sit quietly, we listen to the teacher and talk a little bit, and then people go home, and there's not the sense of community, which I think is absolutely necessary. I mean, I've seen some groups do a wonderful job of that. Tri Ratna in Europe, FWBO, the former FWBO people, they do a great job. I was impressed by Zen Mountain Monastery in upstate New York. But in general, I think that's still something that very much has to be worked on. I'm also, I guess I should mention, I'm concerned that, well, no, that's a different point. I'll drop that for the moment. Yeah.
David, what is your perspective on the secularization of Buddhism?
And I also just came from a conference at the Barry Center where it was a colloquium, invitation only, on secular Buddhism. Stephen and Martine Batchelor and a number of others were there. And what was interesting, though, is what we agreed by the end is that we had less idea what it meant, that none of us really knew what secular Buddhism was, including, I think, Stephen, which might have been a good thing.
Well, you know, I mean, you brought up the precept issue.
I'm sorry?
You brought up the precept issue, and one of the expressions of secular Buddhism, like mindfulness-based stress reduction, is basically, you know, not grounded in the threefold training.
Exactly.
Or directly.
Exactly.
And, also, the utilization or the application of these approaches to transforming the mind in contexts that are basically creating a greater adjustment of individuals two dispositive situations, whether it's the military or the prison system or the hospital context or even our economic system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you mentioned, one of the issues has to do with, you know, Buddhism, from one point of view, breeding a kind of passivity,
yep.
kind of acceptance, or some sort of, you know, grander karmic view of things.
Or
why is it, for example, that so many Buddhists in the West, whom I'm associated with anyway, don't espouse that perspective at all, are deeply socially engaged, are, you know, social activists who take a stand, you know, whether it's Ariadne or Thich Nhat Hanh or yourself or myself or, you know, my friend Velcro Ripper, whose film we're going to see tomorrow. You know, people who are deeply engaged in activities that are directed towards social transformation and the transformation of the economic system. So, I mean, I think that we're, you know, what you say on one side is true, that Buddhism's shadow is breeds passivity and acceptance.
But it doesn't have to.
From another point of
view,
it breeds fierce discernment and also a deep sense of social responsibility.
For sure, yep.
And, you know, that's apropos of what Brian was bringing up. If you see philanthropy in terms of the 1%, you know, wicking out the economic system so that one is rewarded for actually hoarding, and then you get a sort of special, you know, approbation for taking care of those who are, you know, less fortunate. This is, to me, a very contrary and dangerous perspective, and it goes very much in line with my good friend, and I think yours too, Bernard Lethier, however you say his name,
mm-hmm.
you know, who made a really important point that we reward people for hoarding money by our interest system, our economic system. So the more money that you sort of hoard up and don't disperse into the system, you're actually rewarded for doing exactly that.
Greed. That's right. Again,
whereas
greed.
The Buddhist perspective is, you know, punya, you know, you accumulate merit by giving away.
Generosity.
Generosity.
Yep. Right.
So it's a complete, you know, opposite perspective from the point of view of economics. When you look at, you know, the Buddhist paradigm as distinct from the Western paradigm. And
maybe
that's,
I can.
People, we're about changing.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't change our economic paradigm, this earth is not going
to. That's clear. That's clear. Yeah. I just wanted to add a footnote to that. Some months ago, I wrote a letter to a well-known businessman. In fact, he teaches at MIT, and he's well-known for mindfulness, trying to introduce mindfulness into the business place, named William George. He used to be head of Medtronic, so very successful. No. But the reason I wrote to him is, number one, he's been meditating since the 70s, and it's clearly a very important part of his life. He's been to Mind Life. He's worked with some Rinpoche. But I also discovered reading about him that he's on the board of Goldman Sachs and ExxonMobil. So I asked him, well, I'm confused, and because this is a huge issue now. Can you please give us some insight? How does your practice give you a different perspective on what's going on with these two very problematical corporations? And how are you able to use your influence in a positive way? And he never responded, so 4 months later, I finally went public with that letter, which is on the BPF website, among others.
Also, it's in, you know, the paper that Ron and his associate.
That's right. Yeah, actually, Ron and I are working together. Yeah.
We're
running out of time, but maybe, well, one very last quick question. Yes, sir.
Well, I find what you say very compelling, but I also feel it has several assumptions that are a little bit disturbing, or that I'm not sure that are illuminating. One is that the world needs fixing, that it's not okay the way it is. And I'm disturbed by global warming, but the idea of trying to change that also implies that somehow it's immortal, the world itself, just as if we would like ourselves to be immortal. The third thing is, in relation to the institutionalization of greed, whenever in the past we've tried to change those social systems, You created violence by using force to change those things. And it's in a form of aggression itself. And so the effect of changing it, or putting in a system where we can put it within people's minds, or people in power, to make those decisions at the market. I'm not essentially a capitalist market believer, but if you're going to engage this dialogue, you have to address the idea that the market forces themselves are natural, and that when you try to go against them by appointing people to change them or to make decisions, you're implying force. And in the past, that's turned out very bad whenever we tried to do that. So what is the alternative to trying having a more mindful political system?
Yeah. Well, those are wonderful questions. They're also very long ones and complicated. With regard to the first, let me just say, repeat what Shinryu Suzuki said to his students, because I think it applies to our situation. There's two sides to it. You know, he said, you're all perfect just as you are, but you could all use a little improvement. And part of being a Zen student is seeing both dimensions, and in your life, in your practice, and in your bodhisattva engagement in the world, bringing those two, keeping those two together. In fact, that may be the most important thing that Buddhism has to offer, is this new conception of the bodhisattva who is working on herself, her own personal transformation, as much as working for social change. Regarding climate change, from the larger perspective, the Earth will correct itself. My own personal preference, given the joys and the beauties of human creativity, it'd be nice if we were around to continue to be a part of it. And that may well not happen, but I think most of us have that preference. And finally, in terms of market forces, I guess I do disagree. I don't think that the way capitalism envisages is our situation, that there's anything natural about it. It's historically conditioned in certain kinds of ways. But this is precisely where I think Buddhism has something so important to offer. You are completely right about the violence and the aggression with which capitalism has been fought and has fought itself. And yet, the wonderful thing about Buddhism and the emphasis upon nonviolence, the emphasis on being aware of the anger and the violence within ourselves and dealing with that, I see Buddhism as a prime example of how we might be able to bring a new perspective, a new kind of process, a new kind of work on the social dimension to bear on the economic crisis that we have, which doesn't have to involve violence. At least I see that as a possibility. Whether that's what will happen, I don't know.
I don't mean violent overthrow or enforcing. I mean when you tell someone that they have to, when they spend their money a certain way, that is a form of force, and that is a form of aggression.
Let's continue. I mean, we're late, and I want to make sure people got a problem, but I'm happy to continue the discussion. And it's just that I was given strict instructions on time that I've already passed. So I've done violence to our time. So thank you all very much.